I didn't tell you that I was a comedian. Part of the beginning of each presentation has to start with a little comedy. And so you've had your comedy. And I really appreciate the prayer. I think it was necessary because of, you know, the weight and heaviness of the part of Hillary's America that you saw. You know, that was a dark period of American history. And you know, fortunately, you know, we've passed far beyond that. And today, the KKK, you know, it's almost non-existent. The last numbers I saw a few years ago, there may be 4,000 in the country. But one reason is that, you know, people have other outlets. They don't have to belong to the KKK or the neo-Nazis. But there are people, you know, that have a number of concerns. And I alluded to some of that yesterday. And some of the writings I have done more recently, I was invited to write for the Financial Times. And for those of you all that know the Financial Times, it's a, it's the major rival newspaper to the Wall Street Journal, and it has a bigger reach. And they wanted me to write about President Trump's white support. And because I wrote a book in 2002 about white nationalism, there's been a lot of people that wanted me to say that President Trump was a white nationalist and all the people who supported him. And I have not been willing to say that. I'm one of the people who voted for President Trump, and I went to Pennsylvania, I knocked on doors, and worked with the Mighty American Strike Force that was formed in Texas, and now I think they're across the country. And so, but I do acknowledge that there are a particular set of concerns that white people in America have that they probably never had before. And there are two researchers at Princeton University, Angus Deaton and Ann Case, and they have done research on white Americans that show that there's a rising mortality rate, that, you know, we try to keep mortality rates down, but for white people, especially middle-aged males, that's where it started, that they were dying prematurely, and that are preventable causes. And you saw a suicide, drug overdoses of prescription, as well as illegal drugs, certain types of diseases. And they called these deaths, deaths of despair, deaths of hopelessness. And there are some surveys that show that just about every other group in America, ethnic and racial groups, and I can't speak for Native Americans because I don't know if they were surveyed, but certainly for African Americans and Hispanics, they were optimistic, but for whites, they were filled with despair. And what's even more distressing for anyone that cares about human beings is that this is seeping down to younger groups. And so there are whites, you know, maybe ages 25 to 40, where their mortality rates are increasing as well. And they decreasing. I get that mixed up sometimes. What I'm trying to tell you all is people are dying younger of preventable causes. And there's a book that's been on the New York Times bestseller by J.D. Vance called Hillbilly Eulogy. And J.D., like me, was one of the ones that got out of the situation of poverty that he wasn't supposed to escape from. And when we hear people talk about white privilege, you know, there are some white people that are privileged, just like there are some blacks that are privileged and people that were born into privilege. But there are also a lot of poor whites in Appalachia and in parts of the country that have generational poverty. And they look a lot like the blacks and Hispanics and I guess Native Americans that are trapped in poverty and that children almost never go to college. A lot of these people are killing themselves and they're using drugs, and so they are left behind. And they may be on government entitlement programs, but those programs are not really helping improve the quality of their lives. And so there's a lot of misery in America. And but I have been asked to write about that, and believe it or not, CNN this year had me write two opinion pieces for them. They recruited me to write about the inauguration, as well as President Trump's immigration ban, the first one. And you know, my voice is being heard in unlikely forms, and I do give God credit for the doors of opportunity that have opened up for me. Those of you that were here last night saw the kind of grueling poverty that I was born and raised in. I was one of 12, high school dropout, and all of my siblings, we all dropped out after the eighth grade because of the poverty that we were in. My older sister and I, we married early. You know, by the time I was 20, I had three children, one died, and I was able to turn my life around by getting a high school equivalency, going to a community college that was the first of five college degrees. And I didn't plan any of it in the sense that there was not a point where I said, I want to get a PhD. That was not my plan. I just wanted a job. I wanted a good paying, a well-paying job. I'd been in an abusive marriage situation, and I just wanted to be able to support myself without a man's income. And I know that a lot of people have made decisions, you know, to live with people they were not married with, and that's a part of our culture. But I never made that decision. And Elizabeth Taylor, I understand she was a serial monogamous in her marriage. So she married the men she slept with. Some of them. And that was one way to do it, you know, another generation. But it was important to me, you know, because I was in a situation that was abusive, and I felt like I could not afford to leave because I didn't have the money to pay the rent. And so that's what got me pursuing my education. And the reason I'm sharing this is that in a room this size, there are other people that are either in my situation or they've been in my situation. And so I would like to, you know, encourage you that God looked out for me even before I knew God. I came, my conversion experience happened late in life in my 40s. That I became a devout believer. But when I look back over my life, you know, God knew that someone like me needed a job with job security. He knew about tenure before I did. and so I got steered into academia, and I was very successful in academia. You know, I won national prizes, I was tenured at Princeton, and I was at the top when, you know, God just sort of changed my life, and I started this spiritual journey that resulted in me exploring New Age religions, Eastern religions, and I sort of went full circle and had a very dramatic conversion experience and became a devout believer about over 17 years ago. And during that time, mostly I mentioned last night that I was very shy, just so shy that if someone asked me my name, I would forget it. And if I had to introduce someone or something like that, I would have it on a piece of paper, and the paper is shaking, and I'm reading it. And I was always clutch to the lectern. And after I had my conversion experience, I was free to just move around and to, you know, just walk out into the audience because I felt like God impressed on my mind that He had given me a message that was bigger than me. And that if I focused on the message and not on myself, then I could do what I needed to do. And where I am today when it comes to the public speaking and getting involved more in politics, because I have become you know, active in the Republican Party in a way that I was never so active in the Democratic Party, my journey has not been a journey that even I anticipated. People ask me all the time, am I going to run for office? Am I called to run for office? I don't feel like God has called me to run for office. I do feel like God has called me to hold people and institutions accountable. And, you know, it's been politicians of both parties, and there's some things about the church that are really, really wrong. And I find myself speaking about some of those things, and sometimes I feel like the skunk at the garden party. And the role I see myself playing in life is not one that I necessarily, you know, I feel like I'm wired to being outside And there's some of you that are wired the same way. And, you know, like, there's certain parts of it you can control, and there are other parts that it's harder to control. And you know, like, God wears us differently. And there was a time when I was very critical of people that I felt should stand up, and they should do this, and they should do that. And I'm not so critical, certainly, of certain aspects of other Christians that do it differently than me, because I know I'm called to the front lines. And there's a place for people that are not on the front lines. If they ever start chopping off the heads of Christians, they will come for me and for those on the front lines first. And I think those that are more in the closet or more hidden, that they will rise to the forefront when they need to rise to the forefront, and they would do what needs to be done. And so I have confidence in the process. And we know that's God's process, going back to Elijah when he killed the prophets of Baal, and he thought he was the only one left. And God said, I have 7,000 others I reserved for myself. And so we know that we may think we're the only one, but in many of these institutions, there are far more people who agree with us than are actually speaking. And so, and I feel that that's the case for the university, that there are many people that are not on board with what's taking place. They would like to see changes. They don't know exactly what to do, but they're not on board with what they see. And I think that God will raise up leaders, and that a lot of the leaders will come from the young people. And last night I was very encouraged, you know, by the young people I saw in the audience, because I see God raising up young people, and a lot of them have courage and they have energy, and a lot of us are called to be advisors, and you know, and we want to glamorize and think we're going to be advisors to, you know, presidents and senators and kings and queens, but I think God has called in some of us to be advisors to the young people, because they're going to be those senators and representatives, and if we do our job well, they're going to carry the values, they're going to have the wisdom, and they're going to be able to make changes that we can't make. So that is my little preface before I get into whatever the title is of today's talk. Which I think is something about progressivism. And it sounds, it makes it very pleasant. It's a word, you know, it sounds great. Progress, progressivism, moving forward. Who can be against progress? And yet we know that progressivism is a theory, a philosophy that of using technology, science, human ingenuity to move mankind forward. And it's very secular, you know, it pretty much leaves God out of the equation. It has roots in the Enlightenment, and it's something that, you know, followed, you know, to its logical conclusion, it moves people away from any reliance that there's a supreme being that could be over all of this. And so if you look at the roots of progressivism, it started off, you know, with William Jennings Bryan and Prohibition. It has changed over time. A lot of things change over time. And so at that time, you know, people saw the evils of alcohol, and they were trying to control certain things, and they saw abuses of children and women. And so there were some legitimate issues that the progressives addressed. And they were not, they believed in planning just like the Marxists and socialists, but they were not pure socialists. And when you think about the progressives, you think of Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they were some of the progressives. And many of the progressives, you know, they were Democrats, but we can't say that they were, you know, they were not aligned with the Marxists and the communists of their day. They could see the evils of communism back in the beginning when you saw progressivism. But, you know, there's that expression, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And some parts of progressivism have been paver stones in the road to hell. And so, you know, like, there's good, there's bad. There are things that start off good and they get turned into things that are evil. And tied to the progressive movement was this whole eugenics movement and philosophy that many of the progressives, the early ones, believed in eugenics. And that was, and we see with the National Institute of Health today and some of the projects that they fund, that many of the things that they have done, you know, border on that, because they want to make a better human being. They want to use science, you know, to eliminate certain types of genetic propensities, and, you know, they can create a genius, and they can create all these people, designer babies. And so some people would say that that's progress, that's progressivism, that we have tamed science. And so we've gotten to the point now that we're doing these experiments with animals and human embryos, and we're creating, I think they call them chimeras. These are living beings that are part human and part animal. And your tax dollars are supporting that. And so, you know, like, even though I'm a social scientist and, you know, I'm aligned loosely with the university, but philosophically, I'm in favor of President Trump cutting funds to organizations like that, because do we really want our tax dollars being used in that type of experimentation? It's like Frankenstein to a certain extent, because you don't know what you're creating. You don't know, you know, if you create something that's part human and part animal, what that, you know, if that person had, if that thing has reasoning abilities, and just whatever you do with science, you can't really control it. And some of the things, you know, that have happened with HIV and Ebola and stuff like that, you know, there's these conspiracy theories. I talked a little bit about them. When you call someone a conspiracy theorist, sometimes you're just trying to shut them up. But there are people that believe that some of the things that we can't control, that were created in labs as part of biological warfare. I don't know, and I'm not going to say that that's the case, but I know that humans have gotten, you know, they're dabbling in areas that they shouldn't be. But going back to the eugenics movement, we know that Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, that she felt that there were certain human beings that shouldn't reproduce. And so it was not just blacks and, you know, Hispanics and probably Native Americans. It was also, you know, people like the Irish or certain other groups, that she called them human weeds. And that we did not need the human weeds. And she spoke to the KKK. She gave presentations with the Ku Klux Klan. And you look at the Democratic Party and how she's hailed and how she is extolled. And we had, you know, Secretary of State Clinton praising her. We know that this woman had very, very evil intent, very evil roots. She was a product of her day. And there were many intellectuals, you know, coming from Harvard and those elite institutions that a lot of us hold in high esteem, they were all on board with eugenics. And many people were sterilized, you know, during the 1930s. In the movie, they talk about Carrie Buck, that she was sterilized because she was believed to be feeble-minded. And I don't know what her IQ was, but she was not on board with being sterilized. She was forced to be sterilized. And in the 1960s, 1970s in Virginia, I had several of my cousins that went into the hospital giving babies, they're given birth out of wedlock. And while they were in the hospital, you know, they finished their labor pains, doctors put papers in their hands and signed to be sterilized. And then later they got married and they wanted to have children, but they had been sterilized. And so, I mean, thousands of women, many of them poor, were sterilized, and it wasn't that long ago. And so it has been a policy of our government and a policy of the elites, you know, to try to control population. And there's a lot of evil that is taking place in this country. And the reasons why many of us have to be concerned, and again, you talk about some of this stuff and you're believed to be a conspiracy theorist, but I mean, there are people that are saying that there have been a number of doctors, many of them in Florida, that have died under suspicious circumstances. And these were doctors that were saying that something was being put in vaccines that increased the likelihood that a person would get cancer. we know with the political left, they're very concerned about the environment. And people have a large carbon footprint. And some people would argue that a baby has such a huge carbon footprint that it's much, you know, you could recycle forever. And they would argue that you wouldn't come up with the savings, a reduction in the carbon footprint, as you would get if you, you know, did not have that child. And in our government, with the Mexico City policy where we give our money was being used in other nations to support abortions in those countries. And some of those countries are Catholic countries where the people would have a natural propensity not to abort. But it's all about third world countries and to keep the population down so that there isn't such a big carbon footprint. And the Affordable Care Act, you know, some of the provisions there, Sarah Palin famously said something about death committees, and you know, she was mocked. But decisions are being made about who gets what kind of health care at a certain age that effectively is a death sentence if you can't afford to get the health care that you need. And all of that's taken place, and it's taken place, some of that's taken place because the people, you know, that are pulling the strings is that they don't want the world to be so populated. They're more concerned about their role of saving the environment than they are about living, breathing human beings. And so I think that we have to watch and be wary about a lot of the things that come out of Washington. And the guy John Holdren, that President Obama made his science czar. One of the books that he co-authored talked about putting things in people's food that would cause sterilization. And it was a co-authored book, and that got some press coverage, you know, in the conservative media. It's not something that we had a national debate about, you know, in the mainstream media. And people argued, well, he was a co-author to the book, but they were actually talking about putting things in our food supply so that we couldn't reproduce. And so there's so much that's taken place. And all this is progressivism. And I realize that with the progressivism, you find intellectuals probably in both parties that are part of it, and especially libertarians. And in the case of libertarians that are Republican, they're fiscal conservatives, but on a lot of these issues, they're right on board with the Democrats. Elites, they seem to share the same set of values. And on those issues, they find themselves, you know, pretty much aligned, so that it's not a straightforward, you know, the Democrats are evil, they support this, and the Republicans are righteous. If you look at the party platforms, there's a stark difference between the party platforms. That the Republican Party and the Tea Parties, you know, pretty much the Tea Parties, they really do seem to, the ones I know, and they may be different in some places, that they are focused on God, country, and family. And that was what the Republican Party used to be truly focused on. But now in the Republican Party, you know, you see the Bushes and various elites that are on board with, you know, with gay marriage, with abortion, with things that are certainly not biblical, not part of a biblical worldview. And I recognize, and you should recognize too, that the Republican Party, no, it's not a church. It's not a church. But it has pretty much stood with American values of individual liberty, limited government, private property, free markets, and the sanctity of life. And, you know, if they ever lose that totally, and they have been challenged in so many ways that they're close to losing it, we will end up with a situation where the two parties will be almost indistinguishable. And at that point, either another third party will emerge, because the Republican Party was birthed as the anti-slavery party. It came out of a split. And I think we are facing a situation now that many people who are Republicans, you can't assume that they share the values that we have traditionally considered American values. And with the Supreme Court, I'm very concerned when all of our justices come from the Ivy League because of the education that they get. A lot of that education is progressivism and this whole idea of a living constitution. Now we have a living Bible, and with the living constitution, you know, we argue that we shouldn't look at the founders or the framers or what their intentions may have been because they were wealthy, you know, white men with property, that the document that they put together should not control us in any sort of way. That's part of the argument. But that they would argue that the Constitution is supposed to change because the framers, that they couldn't have anticipated the society we live in now. And so they make the case for inventing new rights. And so using the right to privacy as a way to legalize abortion or to legalize gay marriage and to do all these creative things that they have done. But with the justices that are trained at those Ivy League schools, Republicans have not done a great job of picking people that are going to be true to core values, core American values. And so when we have someone like this Gorsuch, you know, we hope and pray that he will be true on all, he will be, you know, true on all the traditional issues that matter to Christians with a worldview. But he's a member of a liberal Episcopalian church, and they have not been traditionally conservative on a lot of issues that many other Americans are conservative on. And so we hope, we pray for the best, but the American Bar Association and those organizations that have give that stamp of approval, they almost never give that stamp of approval to anyone that doesn't have that Ivy League background. And so that means that all the other law schools where people go, real Americans go, you know, they have a slim chance of clerking for a Supreme Court justice or actually serving on the Supreme Court. I think that's wrong, and I think that's another area where we the people need to stand up. Last night, all of these books, you know, this book is gone. It can be ordered online, but I have a book called Be the People, A Call to Reclaim America's Faith and Promise. And in that book, I really emphasize the need for the we the people to stand up and take responsibility and ownership of the problems of America, because we elect the politicians, they enact the policies and programs on our behalf, and if we don't like what they're doing, then we have a system for changing it. And I believe as Christians, God will certainly hold us accountable for the government. Like, we may not be in favor of abortion, we may not be in favor of experimenting with animals and human beings, but because we elected those leaders and we allow our money to be used in that way, God deals with nations. And throughout history, he has judged nations, and we're part of that nation. And some of us may be part of the nation that's not on board with what's taking place, and so we hope and we pray for change. But I think that we will be held accountable for the nation that we have and what we allow to take place. And the dysfunction that we see in many minority communities, I mean, that part of that comes about because the elites, now I'm going to talk about the Democratic Party more specifically, but, you know, like if you talk to the average person, certainly the average minority, they see the Democratic Party as their friend, and they believe that the Democratic Party is the party of civil rights, and it's always been their champion. And when you look at history and you look who voted for the Civil Rights Act and just the things that the parties have endorsed, there's nothing to support that that is the Democratic Party. And the theory of the big switch, I mean, they would tell you, oh yeah, the Democrats used to be bad guys, but they switched. Now the Republicans are the bad guys. Dinesh and scholars have shown that that's not really true. That certainly for African Americans, they started voting for the Democratic Party back in the 1930s, the New Deal policies, that was when they started voting for the party of the Klan. They knew it was the party of the Klan, so they were probably holding their nose, but they benefited from some of those programs. But it was the Republican Party all the way that was the party that was principled. And you look at the Southern whites, you know, the Southern whites are supposed to be racist, and they, the narrative that a lot of Democrats give is that after the Civil Rights Act, the white Southerners, you know, switched to the Republican Party. But the statistics don't show that. Very few leaders switch party, just a handful of them switch parties. And with the whites, the poorest of whites stayed in the Democratic Party, and the Republicans grew in strength as racism declined. So in the 1970s, 1980s, that was when the South became more solidly Republican. And that was during the time when blacks, you know, were doing well. Racism in the South was declining, had declined significantly. And once the Civil Rights Act was passed in the 1960s, you know, the black vote, Democrats had to do something to maintain power. And so you saw, you know, them begin to change that strategy and bring in some blacks. And the Congressional Black Caucus, they were formed in the early 1970s, and I think in the late 60s there may have been 8 or 9 black members of Congress. But with Congressional Black Caucus, the Democrats have used them in ways that have not benefited the rank and file black person. And when Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote his treatise on the black family, and he talked about the concerns that it was becoming matriarchal, that there was a pattern that was developing that he saw as dangerous. At that time, I think it was something like 20% of black households were headed by women. And so he issued a warning, and he was roundly denounced and, you know, called all sorts of names for that and sort of retreated, because he was a liberal. But they beat him up pretty badly over that. And now we know that in the black community, it's probably about 70% are headed by single-headed households, and that a lot of poverty that you see among minorities, whether it's, you know, blacks, whites, or other groups, is because single-parent households, for the most part, they don't have the same income if you don't have two wage earners. And so a lot of that poverty is because of that, and you can trace it to some governmental policies. And that guy, Charles Murray, he has written about this. And one of the things that Charles Murray and others have pointed out is that some of the social welfare programs actually made people worse off. The aid to families with dependent children had a rule that you could not have a man in the house. And so that meant that if a family was poor and they needed assistance, they had to get rid of the man, kick him to the curb to be able to get welfare. And so that sort of accelerated the rate of separation and divorce in the black community. And if I look at a lot of the blacks that I know of the older generation, their profile is more like a lot of the whites I know, that they've been married. You know, they may have gone through ups and downs, but they've been married, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, that the black community had a merged culture. In the 1950s, they had a culture, and you can't say that it broke down because of slavery, that this dysfunction you see today is because of slavery, because that was not how the black community looked up until the mid-1960s. And so it was governmental policies that contributed to the decline of black families. And also, the social scientists, I blame, you know, social science for a lot of the problems. They came up with this, I don't know, it's not really a theory, but I don't know, I'll tell you what it is and you tell me what it is. This thing that we shouldn't blame the victim. And so, I mean, in the 1960s, they talked about not blaming the victim. And then they started saying that, really pushing the idea that there was no ideal family structure, that single-headed households at that time were equivalent to two-parent families. All the data show that children do best when they're in homes with their biological parents. And, you know, then second would be with step-parents. But they do better when they have a mother and a father. And the research that supports this is not conservative research from the Family Research Council, even though
there's research that supports that. But it's, again, some professors at Princeton that are liberal, that they say the same thing. And if you look at the upper class, and I heard Charles Murray talk about his book, Coming Apart, which really focuses on whites, is that the upper class whites, the elites that you see at these universities, that they have something like, it used to be a 94% of them were married. That has dropped to about 84%. But they are deeply committed to marriage and to values, and they live by a totally different set of norms and values than what they encourage other people to have. And if they were to speak out and tell other people what they do to be successful, then you might have a different pattern among the lower classes. And you think about, and he talked about with white people, that I think only 64% are married now, but some decades ago, it wasn't that long ago, I don't have the numbers in the top of my head, it was like maybe in the 80s, it could have been like 84% of the working class whites were married. They were kind of, they were still committed to the marriage culture. Now that stands at 64%, but he said that there are a lot of idle white men that are staying home playing video games. And they're just totally, you know, they're part of that entitlement society that we had today. And you may recall that when President Obama was elected, that it wasn't long before the number of people on food stamps, it just skyrocketed. You saw all of these people that looked, some people were pretty middle class looking, that qualified for food stamps if they were unemployed or something like that. It became very, very easy to get food stamps. And I happen to know this because I can tell you a personal story. One of my sons in Nashville was unemployed, and so he was living at home with me, and he went out and he applied for jobs, and he apparently wasn't getting jobs. I later learned that he was turning down jobs, but he was turning down jobs that weren't paying what he wanted. But at some point, he was told to apply for food stamps, and he's living with me. And he brought home a paper, and he told me that I needed to fill out a certain part of the paper for him to be able to get the food stamps, and I wasn't going to fill out that paper. And I didn't fill out that paper. The paper was never turned in, but they sent him a $400 food stamp voucher. And then, you know, like, there was something else that happened that I found very interesting, too. This involves that same son. And he's doing very well now. He has a great job. And but I learned a lot by watching my family. This is part of the story that I wanted to tell you is escaping me right now. Oh, I know. Is that he didn't normally get children. He didn't normally get tax returns. And some of you may remember that on YouTube there was this woman that she said that with President Obama being elected, it was the happiest day of her life because she wouldn't have to worry about how she's going to pay her rent or all of this stuff like that. And YouTube went viral. And she was saying she was good to him, he'd be good to her. Well, my son had never, in recent years, gotten a tax refund. But that year after Obama was elected, he got a check for like $700. And I never was quite sure how he got that refund. But he got that check. And, you know, and so I don't know. You know, maybe there was some money that was distributed to people that were poor because he had been unemployed. And so he was poor by that means, but there was no reason to explain rationally how he got that refund. So I don't know what was going on in our culture, but I do know that there were people that started getting entitlements, and then when we switched our government, switched food stamps from those ugly bills that yes. poor people were ashamed yes. to carry around, because everyone would know that, you know, they had food stamps. Mm-hmm. It was like a dollar bill that said PO, you know. And so if someone wanted to use that, you know, if you had any, you know, pride, you did it early in the morning, late at night, and with a disguise on, like glasses and a hat. But they switched it to a debit card, and you just
give someone a debit card, you know, unless the clerk may know what they look like, but the average person didn't. It made it a lot easier for people to use that. And a lot of the changes that have taken place in our society is because we don't have any more stigma. And even though stigma is bad, stigma is good too. And those behaviors that we see among some of the lower classes, and I'm talking about it, you know, all the lower classes, because the lower class whites look very much like the lower class minorities. I mean, lower class is lower class. A lot of things that we see and we think is about race, it's really about social class. If there was a little bit of stigma, then you would see a different behavior patterns. And if you wanted to reduce food stamp usage, then you would go back to those ugly bills that people carried around that they weren't so thrilled about being seen with. That's how you would do it. But what the government has done, I would argue, is put in place a set of incentives that for the most part, I think they encourage people not to better themselves. And I believe that that's part of the problem. And I'm hoping that with President Trump, that he doesn't just listen. You know, it's great to meet with the CDC and to meet with Democrats. It's great to meet with them, but it'd be very dangerous to take policy advice from them because nothing that they have ever pushed has actually worked. And it's made us worse off. And so there's a need for creativity, and there's a need to return to federalism where states have rights and incentives to experiment, because states were supposed to be the laboratories. Like states were supposed to have the freedom to come up with ideas to address particular problems, and then if their ideas were effective, then they could be copied by other states. And so you would have states doing more, not just looking to the federal government. And if we want to return America back towards a constitutional form of government, then we have to find a way to empower and give incentives to states to begin to address some of the problems that are affecting people. And we also need to empower some of those people on the ground that are in those communities that are doing, you know, the grunt work. A lot of times, you know, they don't really have voice. That when the national government, when the media, not even say to the when the president, a lot of times when they want to talk to people, they go to the ones that are easy to find. You know, that they have the black spokesperson. I don't know, but in the Native American community, in the Hispanic community, they have people, you know, that they come out and those people do the talking. Yet, there are other people that are working in the communities. And sometimes they're the people that are directly affected by the programs and policies. They have a lot of common sense. It's not all about having, you know, people from the elite schools making policy, because sometimes you have people that all they've done all of their lives is go to school and be good at going to school. And then because they were good at going to school and, you know, they have books and they have articles written for other people like them, they get put in charge of programs and they don't have a clue about the needs of the people. If you really want to solve problems, you go talk to the people themselves. And I know that I have an uncle that has probably a third grade education. He could advise them on a lot of public policies. But we all know people like that, that they actually know because they have common sense. And education does not guarantee that you have common sense. You know, you can be a genius, have a 200 IQ, and still not have a bit of common sense.
That's right.
And that's what we see taking place at the universities. We see just total nonsense. And we also see university administrators, whether they agree with what's taking place or not, they're total cowards. And so they actually don't stand up to the students. And so when the students demand crazy things, they give it to them. They appease the students. I think they're afraid of the students. And what we need is adults, you know, in charge, not just of universities, but other institutions. And in our churches, we need pastors that trust God, that they trust God enough, and they love people enough, and they believe the Bible enough that they're going to tell people the truth, even if it means they lose some. And some of the people that they're losing is because they're not bold enough to speak truth.
Right.
And so as a consequence, they're losing members of their congregation because people just are not going to stand there and, you know, contribute to something that they know is a losing proposition. So that pretty much is the bulk of what I have to say. I would gladly take your questions now.
Thank you.
Well, we need some questions.